Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
All right. This Benny J bonus interview is brought to you in part by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, Local 126 and District 8, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 9, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150, and the Chicago Federation of Labor. Benny J, take it away.
Bonus time on the Ben Jarofsky Show. As I speak, it's Wednesday, December 4th, 2019. December 4th has significance. We'll get to that later. The front page of my beloved Bright One, the Chicago Sun-Times, is filled with a story called Eddie's Night Out. What a headline. Eddie Johnson, up to no good at a bar. I've been obsessively talking about it, but that's not what we're going to talk about on Bonus Time on the Ben Jarofsky Show.
That's correct.
Thank you, Robert Mueller. We're going to take the deep dive with my distinguished guests. And as I always do on Bonus Time on the Ben Jarofsky Show, I ask my distinguished guests to introduce him or herself. So without further ado, distinguished guest, introduce yourself.
Yes. First, I want to say, Ben, I've been lobbying to be on your show for years, and I'm really happy to be here now. And my name's Flint Taylor, and I'm an attorney with the People's Law Office and have been for well nigh 50 years now.
All right. Flint Taylor is a troublemaker with a capital T. We'll get into his long and distinguished career here in the city of Chicago. When I say long and distinguished, it means he's old like me. And he's filed many cases against the police department regarding a torture of suspects. So any police officers have complaints, his name is Flint Taylor. I'm Ben Jarofsky. Just kidding. They're not scared. Anyway, Flint Taylor, one of the reasons, first of all, thank you for being on the show. I think there was a moment when I was going to have you on the show and then I got fired. So blame it on getting fired. You are the author of a book about police torture in the city of Chicago, and we'll get into some of those cases. But I would really want to talk, The Torture Machine is the name of the book, but I really want to talk about at the outset anyway, is a case that I first read about you when you were the lawyer who took the city to task for the assassination of Fred Hampton. And today happens to be the 50th anniversary. I cannot believe, Flint Taylor, so much time has gone by. I wasn't even a young man. I was a little lad, you know, and I read about it as one of these obsessive kids reading newspaper political stories. I remember Flint Taylor, you know, you were the lawyer who filed the suit and forced disclosures. And I jokingly say this, I've been saying this all day. Today's media is filled with every freaking detail you could ever want or not want about what Eddie Johnson drank and when he drank it and where he was drinking it and who he was drinking with and was he kissing her? Was he his wife? But when it came to shooting Fred Hampton in the middle of the night while he was sleeping, drugged, I will say, when he was sleeping, oh, no, we don't need any details. We'll believe whatever the police tell us, mm-hmm. Flint Taylor. Isn't that interesting, the city of Chicago?
Well, you got to give it to Fran Spielman. She got all that information about Eddie Johnson over at the bar over there.
Not just Fran Spielman, but there was like eight reporters working on that story. Eddie Johnson. All right, let's go back in time to 1969. Good God. And tell folks, our millennial listeners, about Fred Hampton and what went down on December 4th.
Well, Fred Hampton was a remarkable young leader. And you say you were young back then. Well, he was 21 years old. And he had already accomplished a tremendous amount in his life. And he was very charismatic as a young Black Panther leader. He was very powerful. He could go almost anywhere and speak, and people would listen and be transfixed by what he had to say. That's who he was, and that's why the government was so afraid of him. He was an up-and-coming star, as it were, in the Black Panther Party. And J. Edgar Hoover in Washington and Edward Hanrahan, the state's attorney here, Richard J. Daley, the first mayor, the first Daley mayor, of course, the police department were all targeting him in the Black Panther Party in 1969.
And there was a story in the Reader that I've been talking about a lot lately that ran in 1990, but they put it back online, and it's getting a lot of hits. By a good friend of mine, Michael Irvin. He talked about William O'Neill. And William O'Neill was a police informant who was keeping tabs on Fred Hampton and provided the layout of the apartment where Fred Hampton lived, right here on Madison, not far from this very studio where you're sitting right now, Flint. And then he committed suicide. So, in other words, when you say the police were watching, it wasn't just a matter of just sort of reading the newspaper articles about Fred Hampton. They were actually spying on him.
Well, it was more than spying. What we're talking about here is a program that came straight from Washington called COINTELPRO. And COINTELPRO was about as illegal and violent and unconstitutional as a program that the government has ever spawned. And J. Edgar Hoover, of course, was behind it. And here in Chicago, William O'Neill was one of the main informant provocateurs that worked for the FBI and worked in that COINTELPRO program. And he is the one, of course, who, as you said, got the floor plan of the apartment that showed where Fred Hampton would be sleeping. And that floor plan became a basis for the raid on 2337 West Monroe Street.
Mm. And by the way, so just curious, before we go further with the details, the Republican Party right now and Donald Trump are very concerned about the unwarranted intrusion of the Justice Department into the affairs of citizens. The citizen in particular is Donald John Trump. I just want to know, you've been following this story for a while. Did Donald John Trump or anybody related with the Republican Party speak out about the unwarranted intrusion of J. Edgar Hoover's FBI into the life of Fred Hampton in about 1969? Was there any record that you found in a FOIA request that said that young Donald Trump was speaking out behalf of Fred Hampton? Just curious about that question.
Surely you jest. If you remember back in the late 80s in New York with the Central Park Five, who was it that came out and said those young men who were turned out to be very innocent of the Central Park jogger case, who was it that ran a full page ad and said death penalty for these kids?
Donald Trump.
And who was it who, after they were totally exonerated and they found the real rapist and assault person, who said he didn't believe it and never backed off of it and hasn't till this day? And that's who Donald Trump is. And, of course, we can go into all his, you know, white supremacist background, but of course not. Of course he didn't speak out about COINTELPRO, and I'm sure that he and his people over there have been running COINTELPRO-like activities, and perhaps Ukraine, perhaps what Mueller was looking at, perhaps those things can be thought of in that context of rampant government illegality, harkening us back to Richard Nixon and all of that.
All right, I just wanted to make sure that I didn't miss anything there with Donald Trump, suddenly a civil libertarian. All right, so let's go back to 1969. Fred Hampton was killed. Originally, the initial reports, so Chicago, were that there was this furious gunfire, that the Black Panthers were shooting at the cops as the cops were at the door. Then subsequently learned that almost all the bullets were coming the other way from the police into the Black Panther apartment. And Fred Hampton had been drugged, so he wasn't shooting anybody. He was shot while he was sleeping. Is that pretty much the story?
Yes, that's the story that we talk about narratives. And I know you as a writer are very concerned with the truth and narratives. And I happened to be, as a young law student on December 4th, 1969, get the call to go down to the apartment on 2337 West Monroe, because the police left it open. And walked in there as a rather naive white kid in law school, straight from a white suburb in New England. And the shock of it all, to see, you know, the walls with Swiss cheese from all of the bullet holes from the machine guns and the carbines and all the police weapons, to see the blood on the floor where they dragged Fred Hampton's body as a trophy after they shot him in his bed, to see the blood on the bed. You knew that it was a crime scene. But it wasn't a crime scene that the Panthers had perpetrated, but it was a crime scene that the police had perpetrated. However, Hanrahan was very powerful, and he brought the weapons in the apartment back to the state's attorney's office and staged a press conference that all four dailies went for. Chicago Today, the Chicago Tribune, the Sun-Times, and the Daily News, and all the TV stations, which was, as you said, a shootout. That the Panthers fired as many shots as the police, and as Hanrahan was infamously quoted, but for the grace of God, the police would have been killed. But we knew that was a lie from the moment we walked in. We organized over the next 10 days the taking of evidence to show that that was a lie. At first, none of the papers bought it. And it's very interesting. There was a reporter named Tom Dolan. I don't know if you have heard his name or not, but he was a young Sun-Times reporter. He came to the apartment. The Panthers were very intelligent politically. They did tours of the apartment. They showed the bullet holes. They showed the bloody mattress. And you could see, you didn't have to be a genius to see what had happened there. Mm-hmm. And so Dolan went back and he wrote a story for the Times. And he laid it out. And the editor of the Times put it on page 43 next to the obituaries. Dolan quit. That caught enough of the eye of Jim Hogue, who was the editor at the Sun-Times at that time. And we were down there day and night. We had floodlights at night taking evidence. And in walks Jim Hogue straight from the opera with his wife, dressed to the nines in a fur.
Jim Hogue was he later became publisher of the Sun-Times Daily News. Go ahead.
I'm pretty sure he was the editor.
He could have been the editor. Yeah. He was a very glamorous-looking guy, like a Hollywood-looking, a Robert Redford-looking guy.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so he was shown around. And then from that moment, the editorial policy of the Sun-Times and its sister paper, the Daily News, became much more open to the truth of what happened there. So a newspaper war started. And Hanrahan freaked out, the state's attorney, because he was losing leverage in terms of his lie. And so he went to the Trib, not surprisingly, found a reporter named Bob Weidrich over there, and he presented all of the coppers to give their story as a exclusive. And, of course, that was the banner headline. On the Tribune, but they screwed up because they tried to gild the lily with some photos. And they handed two photos over to the Tribune and said, here's the evidence the Panthers were shooting. And then they said, here is the picture of the back door of the apartment. And the back door, Fred Hampton was in the back of the apartment, and the lie they were telling about him was he got up, he had a .45 in his hand, he was firing at the police. Well, of course, he was really shot in his bed through the head. But they said, here are the bullet holes, and they circled them. And then they said, here's a picture of the door from where the Panthers were sleeping, and here's all the bullet holes of where from the cops that from the Panthers shot to the cops. Mm-hmm. Well, it took us about 30 seconds to figure out, because we were in the apartment, that those two circled bullet holes in the back were nail heads, and that all those bullet holes attributed to the Panthers was really a door that was open, flush to the wall where all the machine gun bullets came through. So the Tribune was then embarrassed one more time, and Hanrahan was shown to be a complete liar.
So wait, you unveiled the counter evidence. So the Tribunal wrote the story. They put it on their front page.
Right.
I vaguely remember this. And so then you, kid lawyer with the Black Panthers, held a press conference to rebut the Tribune. Is that how it went down?
Well, we had sources, and I wasn't a kid lawyer. I was a kid law student.
What are you, a kid lawyer? You were a kid law student. a freaking kid.
I was a kid, and I had lawyers who I was working with at the People's Law Office who were, you know, really the ones who,
the grown-ups in the room.
The grown-ups at that time. And by that time, we had, you know, real people we could deal with in, at the Sun-Times and the Daily News. And so we went to them and instantly pointed out that lie and also made some of the Panthers available to the Daily News to tell the real story. So then we really had...
So you had the Sun... for our millennial listeners, the Daily News was a newspaper that went out of existence in 1978, I want to say. Jim Hogue was the publisher of the Daily News when it went out of existence. It was a sister paper to the bright one, the Sun-Times. So you basically had allies, if you will, at both the Sun-Times and the Daily News.
Right. And of course, Hanrahan was had the Tribune in his pocket and the Chicago Today, which was the afternoon Tribune. And he also went to CBS, Channel 2, and did a reenactment. This was, if it wasn't so serious, it was almost clownish. Yeah. Because they set up a fake apartment, and they had the cops reenact what supposedly happened. But they... Not surprisingly, they couldn't get it together. And so they and we were able to get the outtakes. So it would be, you know, I went in the door, and then they shot at me, and then I went this, and they say, oh, shit. And then they cut, and then they go back, and they say, they go. And Hanrahan's first assistant, Richard Jolovec, who really was a point person in this whole raid, uh-huh. along with Hanrahan, and ultimately, you know, with the FBI, of course, secretly involved, mm-hmm. He was there, and they, you know, he was kind of the director mm-hmm. of trying to get this reenactment together. So they had Channel 2 on their team as well. So it that's a whole very interesting part of the case.
Absolutely. And I mean, these are things that I was picking up on even at a very young age, Flint, and they've stayed with me. And people always tease me. I'm on a tangent with a tangent. What do you got against the Tribune? I'm like, man, where do I start? You know? Mm-hmm. And I know there's a lot of great reporters at the Tribune right now. God bless them. I won't name them because they just get in trouble with their bosses if I praise them. But there's that legacy and that history that I think the Tribune doesn't acknowledge, that more often than not, they were like on the wrong side of something going down. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And this was exhibit number A. So I kind of have a hard time when the Tribune gets on its high horse now about Eddie Johnson. Was he kissing his wife in the bar? We need answers. You know, where were you with the bullet holes when you were putting circles around nails?
Yeah.
You know, calling them bullet holes. Like, yeah. You know what? This will all be faded when guys my age pass on to the next one. You know what I'm saying? No one will remember this stuff.
We got to make them remember. That's why I wrote this book. You know?
Absolutely.
You know.
So the next phase of the Fred Hampton investigation, you were getting newspapers to write about it. You have found a few sympathetic reporters at the Sun-Times and at the Daily News. And what was the next then phase in terms of getting the story out?
Well, of course, they had charged the Panthers who survived, the seven Panthers, four of whom were in the hospital with various bullet holes in them, with attempted murder. Because that, you know, was part of the narrative they were putting out. But again, they typical Chicago overreach. They said, well, here are two shells that the woman who was 17-year-old, 4'8" woman, Brenda Harris, laying on a bed in the front room, supposedly fired at the cops to start off the war here that wasn't. And here they are. They match her shotgun. Well, we had an FBI ballistics guy came in, looked at it, and he said, no, you know, those shells didn't come from that Panther mm-hmm. weapon. They came from one of the cops' weapons. So their case, their criminal case, totally fell apart, and they had to dismiss the criminal case. At that point, in rode John Mitchell, of course, of Watergate fame.
Attorney General.
Yeah. And Jairus Leonard, who was his civil rights the guy, you know, sort of like the civil rights guy under Trump, you know, was really about trying to dismantle civil rights. And they came in to do a cover-up. And they came in to do a civil rights quote, investigation, which was really a cover-up. And the major reason that they did the cover-up was because the FBI's role was secret. And so Hanna had something on the feds, which was, you charge me, and I'm going to let them know that William O'Neill, the FBI informant, and my COINTELPRO guy was, your COINTELPRO guy, was behind all of this. So the feds didn't charge anybody. They came up with a report that said, well, there were over 90 bullets fired by the police, and only one maybe by the Panthers, but we don't have probable cause to charge anybody.
Now, wait, time out. When you say that Hanrahan had the goods on the FBI and the feds, and he said, if you push too hard here, I'll unveil this, how do you know that? Is it just surmising on your part, like this is the kind of thing that would happen? Or was there ever any evidence that Hanrahan played that card?
Well, when if you fast forward to our civil rights trial in the mid-70s, we were disgorging, and I mean that in a real sense, from the feds, document by document, the FBI's role in this case. And one of the documents we got, we call the deal document, which outlined this particular deal that Hanrahan and the feds had in order to avoid prosecution by the feds. And the feds, at least to that point, were able to keep O'Neill's identity and role secret.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so wow, he did play that card, Ed Hanrahan.
He sure did.
And so the feds did not did not press charges against anybody.
Right.
There's sort of a split decision. The Tribune says the Panthers shot at the police. The Sun Times and the Daily News are at least entertaining the notion that maybe the police did all the shooting. Then what was the next thing?
Well, the feds now are supporting, you know, that it's a shoot-in. I mean, the math is pretty obvious. 90-1, you know, that's worse than a Bulls score, I think.
Oh,
yeah. Got
you on that one. Yeah, you sure did. Yeah, it is worse than a Bulls score, yeah. My beloved Bulls, go ahead. Yeah.
And so, and then they say, no, but we can't indict anybody. So you can imagine the uproar, particularly in the African-American community, because of what had happened in the community to a young black, to two young black leaders and other
Mark
young
Clark.
People. Yeah, yeah. And so that led to, very grudgingly, the appointment of a special prosecutor in the state court system, a guy by the name of Barnabas Sears.
Yeah.
Who attempted to do an investigation. He did an investigation. He decided that he took it to a grand jury. Hanrahan and the cops had a couple of plants on the grand jury, we found out later. But the grand jury voted 10 to 10 on murder, so they couldn't indict on murder. But they did vote for obstruction of justice and perjury. I know, obstruction of justice, not perjury, against Hanrahan and the cops who fired their weapons in the apartment. That went to trial in the summer and fall of 1972. And what was going on then? Hanrahan was running for re-election. And you got to remember, and I'm sure that you're enough of a student of history, even though you were kind of young at that point, Hanrahan was a rising star. The old man Daley was getting towards the end of his 25-year term, and Hanrahan was his hand-picked successor. And Hanrahan thought that the Panther raid would be a real feather in his political cap because he had a war on gangs. He was falsely trying to equate the Panthers with gangs. All of that was blowing up in his face. So now he's on trial, but he's on trial in front of a machine judge. And the machine, and because he could elect a bench trial rather than a jury trial, the cops and Hanrahan go to a bench trial.
Cook County Circuit Court judge.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Who will remain nameless for this podcast?
I can't remember the name.
Phil Remitti was.
Okay,
his name.
I guess didn't remain nameless for long.
No.
Anyway, all right. So
goes to trial. Uh-huh. Sears puts on all this evidence. It's the clock is ticking. We're getting into the fall. We're getting to within a week or two of the election, and so Sears finishes his case. case is finished, 99 times out of 100, particularly if you have 90 bullets versus one, there's going to be enough evidence to make them put on a defense. Mm-hmm. Well, Remitti looks at his, the calendar and throws the case out a week before the election. Mm-hmm. Hanrahan now can turn to the electorate and say, quitted. I was charged, but that was bogus. The judge threw it out. Well, black community didn't fall for it. Black community was outraged, continued to be outraged. This was even more fuel on the fire. A somewhat moderate or perhaps even a bit of a reformer, Bernie Carey, a Republican. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that's a misnomer in this day and age, but...
pretty much was a misnomer in that day and age, too, but I digress. Go ahead, yeah.
Black community crossed over and voted Hanrahan out of office. And, of course, that I think a lot of historians say that was the start of a political movement that led to Harold Washington.
And then, unfortunately, ended when Harold died. And we will not tell that sob story.
Yes.
Repeat that story and how Richard M. Daley moved on. But you're absolutely correct. Great memory there, Flint, 1972. Black voters stunned the world when they proved that they could vote for a Republican without passing out. And nobody figured they could do that. I guess they didn't think black people knew the difference between an R and a D. They just saw the D, didn't know where they are. Anyway, they crossed over. Bernard Carey, on the strength of black votes in Chicago, defeated Bernard Carey. Defeated Ed Hanrahan. It was a stunning upset. You're right. And it led to, it led to Ralph Metcalf and his insurrection against the machine and ultimately Harry Washington. Okay. So, but you were in the issue of justice for Fred Hampton, you were stymied because this judge found some reason to throw the case. I always find a reason. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I found a reason. So then what'd you do?
Well, that's when our civil case comes in. And that's when Big Jim Thompson decided that he needed O'Neill in the Stanley Robinson case, a case where some drug dealers were killed by a Chicago cop with the assistance of the FBI informant, William O'Neill. So they surfaced O'Neill, who happened to be a client of ours at the time. We had no idea that he was an FBI provocateur. And so now we know, hey, this guy, this Panther, is really an FBI informant. And furthermore, Stanley Robinson, he's a little bit put off by the fact that he's been charged with several murders on the word of an FBI informant. So he tells the Daily News, hey, this is the guy who set up Fred Hampton. So now we have not only clues, but our case is rejuvenated. Our civil case. And so we go after the FBI, we go after O'Neill, and we go after FBI documents.
You filed lawsuits against them.
Well, we had the lawsuit was pending, but it was, it was on appeal.
So Stanley Robinson blew the whistle. That's how it surfaced that William O'Neill was an FBI informant.
Right.
All day long, I've been talking about him, and I keep saying I couldn't remember if he was a Chicago Police Department informant or an FBI informant, but he was an FBI informant. And so did he then testify in your lawsuit?
Yes. What happened was we subpoenaed his files and FBI files. And of course they didn't want to give them to us, but there was a U.S. attorney, an assistant over there, who didn't want to get caught up completely in some kind of cover-up. And so they turned over a few documents, but one document he made sure that we got was the floor plan that I mentioned before that showed that O'Neill had drawn the floor plan that became the basis for the raid against the Panthers at 2337. So that started us on our way. We were then, because he was such a hot potato, so to speak, we were taken secretly to Detroit to question him, and we questioned him. And then we just kept building block, going up the ladder to his control agent. And then as we went towards the trial, we started to learn in the post-Watergate era and the break-in at the Media Pennsylvania FBI offices that there was this program, COINTELPRO.
Yeah.
So that's when we started to really focus on COINTELPRO.
Now, was O'Neill under some kind of witness protection in Detroit? Or
yes. He was under witness protection for many years.
The feds were protecting him?
Yes.
Even though, and then he ultimately testified essentially against the feds.
Well, no, I wouldn't go as far as that. He held the line. He had to admit certain things that were in documents, but he certainly never admitted that he knew that he was setting up Fred Hampton, for example. He never went any farther than he had to in terms of his testimony. And what was interesting was he was paid tens of thousands of dollars in what we called hush money to stay pretty much along the lines of what the keep his mouth shut, so to speak, in his testimony.
Who paid the tens of thousands
of dollars? The government.
I mean,
the feds.
I did.
Yeah.
It's my taxes.
Well, your federal taxes, yeah.
I pay federal taxes.
Yeah, sure
my tax
did.
Dollars.
Probably back then, though, you weren't making enough to pay.
No, back then, I was working at an ice cream factory, packing ice cream,
yeah,
making $1.65 an hour. Oh, my goodness. I did not know about the money, the payoff. So when you say it was paid to be quiet, was it did you ever get documents to that point? To that extent?
Well, no, but it didn't take a genius to look at the fact that, you know, he's getting a few, $1,000 a month supposedly for food and lodging, that was, in essence, you know, to keep him quiet.
Are you listening to this, people in Chicago? This is your history, which undoubtedly will not be taught in any public school anywhere near the city of Chicago. This is unbelievable story. I mean, when you're telling me this story, Flint, it's bringing back memories. I sort of remember each point. I remember Stanley Robinson as a character emerging and Jim Thompson that Flint alluded to. Let's just take a moment for our younger listeners, was the U.S. prosecuting attorney back in the 70s. Sure. And then he went into politics and became governor of the state of Illinois. Now he's a big mover and shaker in a law firm downtown Chicago. But so these are the players. So like Jim Thompson's ambition for higher office, which is motivating him to prosecute Democrats, leads to Stanley Robinson getting prosecuted, which leads to William O'Neill being outed, which leads to you deposing William O'Neill while he's in witness protection in Detroit, and leads to you in searching for records that show that the feds were paying him to shut up, for the fact that he was an undercover operative that was giving out inside information on Fred Hampton's apartment to the feds, who then who were working in conjunction with Ed Hanrahan and the Chicago Police Department to raid that apartment in the middle of the night, and then send out a story that said that Fred Hampton had shot at them, which everybody knew was made up, but the Tribune put on the front page anyway. Do I have it right?
You got it right so far, but we're only about halfway home.
Go, take us. This is fascinating. Go ahead.
So we're in federal court, and we've got, if you'd want to look at Tweedledee and Tweedledum, we've got Tweedledum for a judge, Judge J. Sam Perry, and Tweedledee, of course, is is Julius Hoffman of Conspiracy 8 of Infamy. And Perry is around 78 years old, transplanted from Alabama, and definitely hates the Black Panthers, and derivatively hates me and my partner, Jeff Haas, yeah, who, of course, is with me shoulder to shoulder, along with Dennis Cunningham and others in all of these fights in court. So we're not just getting these documents willy-nilly. We're fighting for them. And as I said, the Frank Church Senate Committee in the wake of Watergate is investigating the FBI and the CIA. So we're kind of running parallel investigations. They're investigating broadly the whole COINTELPRO FBI operations, and we're looking and fighting for the documents here in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, we're able to get a trilogy, the trilogy of documents that show that Fred Hampton was assassinated. And the trilogy, the first part of that trilogy or triangle, whatever you want to call it, is the floor plan that I've mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
The second part of that trilogy comes out just before our 1976 trial. And by trial, I'm talking about my first trial as a lawyer was 18 months long. The Hampton trial was 18 months long.
What year did it start?
It started in January of 76 and went through June of 77.
Damn.
And at the eve of trial, because I was communicating with the young staffer on the church committee that was dealing with the Panthers and the FBI, we were able to unearth the second part of the trilogy, which was a document dated the day before December 4th. December 3rd, 1969, and it was a COINTELPRO document. It was a counterintelligence document, and it said this raid's going to happen, and it's part of our COINTELPRO program. So that's point two. Now we have the floor plan, and then we have them claiming it's part of their program. And then, and this only happened in the middle of our trial, the government witness, the FBI, one of the main FBI witnesses made a slip up on the stand, and it exposed that they were covering up evidence, files. But nobody really understood what that really meant. And the judge, if he understood it, would never have done what he did, which he said to the government, well, bring up those files. Well, there was a guy down on the, from Washington, from Maine Justice, who didn't want to get totally hung up into this cover-up that was going on. So the next morning, they wheeled in 200 volumes of FBI documents that we were supposed to have, and they never gave to us. Documents on Hampton, documents on all the other people.
Were they redacted, or they were just the documents themselves?
First they came up as the documents, and they said, but we got to redact them. So the judge said, okay, take them back and give them to us, you know, file by file with your redactions. Mm-hmm. We said, well, hey, maybe we ought to get a new trial here. You know, we're getting 200 volumes of documents in the middle of a trial, and God knows what's in them. Judge says, no, we're going to continue with the trial. So we keep getting these files, ones and twos and ones and twos, and I'm sitting at counsel table. It's the time for the last couple of those 200 to get. And we've already got a lot of very interesting documents that show, you know, the focus on the Panthers and the breakfast program and all of that. But boom, the last two files are William O'Neill's secret files. And I'm looking through them, and I see a couple of documents. And they became known as the bonus documents. And that's the third part of the trilogy. The bonus documents were FBI documents sent by the control agent of the COINTELPRO program here in Chicago. The control agent for O'Neill saying, hey, this raid was a success. Two Panthers were killed. Others were locked up. Give him a $300 bonus. 30 pieces of silver for O'Neill. Hoover says, sure. So within a week of the raid, the FBI approved and sent William O'Neill $300. And what was he doing at that time when he got his 300? He was one of the pallbearers in Fred Hampton's funeral. So that's the trilogy. That's what we have here that proves, in a way that wasn't able to be proved in terms of Dr. King or Malcolm X. We know that the FBI wanted to destroy them, but we didn't have the documentation that connected, you know, James Earl Ray to the FBI. We just knew that the COINTEL program was trying to destroy King and his organization. Same with Malcolm X. We didn't have that link between the murders in the mosque, the murder in the mosque, and the FBI.
Yeah.
But here,
it wasn't a mosque. It was a ballroom.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Things I remember. It was a ballroom in Harlem. Anyway, right. where Malcolm X was killed.
Yeah.
But so. Wow, Flint. So you have this information. You're in the middle of trial. It's like something out of a Perry Mason thing where all the investigator, Della Street or whatever the guy's name was, comes up with this evidence.
Oh, yeah.
It just turns the trial around. But did it turn the trial around?
No. It helped to turn the narrative around. We had Rob Warden was covering the case.
Oh, Daily News writer.
Yeah, and Dennis Fisher, some other, you know, reporters. We were able to get these documents into evidence and therefore get them into the newspapers. So now what we were saying in the wake of Watergate was making a whole lot more sense in terms of the effort to destroy the Black Panthers and to assassinate Hampton. But that judge wasn't about to let us win the case.
Sam Perry.
Yes. So we went 18 months of trial, put on all of that.
Wait, about, was it a jury trial?
Yes, we had
so
a jury.
So some jury was sequestered for 18 months?
Yeah, I don't think they were sequestered.
But they were, they had to sit there every day.
Sat, yeah,
good
sat,
God.
Sat there for 18 months. And so we get to the end after all that evidence is in.
Uh-huh.
And the jury, despite the fact that, you know, the judge had let all sorts of prejudicial evidence in about how bad the Panthers were, the jury couldn't decide. It was hung. So the judge pulls the same trick that the state court judge pulled and says, well, if the jury can't decide, I'll decide it. Throws it out. Throws it out and says, oh, by the way, I'm going to put a $100,000 appeal bond on you. You have to come up with $100,000 before you can appeal this. Well, we were able to get that appeal bond lifted. We took it up, and we won in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals.
Wait, now, time out. So you were able to get it lifted. You mean you had to appeal to a higher court to force the judge to throw away the appeal bond? Is that
yes.
What, so think about this, folks. You had to go to court to argue that the appeal bond that was limiting them from appealing the judge's decision to throw the case out was unconstitutional and unwarranted. An appellate court, the Seventh Circuit, agreed with you, and so that judge was forced to throw away, to discard the $100,000 bond, and then you could then for free to appeal.
That's right. So then we appealed. We had a 37,000-page transcript that we analyzed and filed a 250-page brief. And in the front cover, we had pictures of Mark Clark and Fred Hampton, and the signature page of the brief, we put all power to the people. So it was an unusual brief.
That is an unusual brief.
And it was also an unusual decision. And I'd always tell law students, go and find this case.
Do you still have the brief, copies of it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That brief... That lays out everything in the case that you just said.
Yeah,
it has the documents that support it and everything.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That's a powerful brief. It should be published.
Well,
I got the Mueller report over there. I should have that brief.
Well, you have Jeff Haas's book and my book, so you
put them together.
Yeah, but yeah. So we appealed and won and the court said we had put on a very strong case of conspiracy under COINTELPRO between the FBI, the police, and Hanrahan to destroy the Black Panthers and Fred Hampton and to cover it up.
So when did this final victory occur?
This happened in 1979.
Ladies and gentlemen, 10 years after Fred Hampton was killed, was it a federal judge that...
It was a three-judge court, and it split 2-1. And also, of course, Jeff Haas and myself had been put in jail by this judge for contempt, and
Perry?
Perry. Mm-hmm. So we were able to overturn that as well. And the court also found that the government had covered up and that they should be sanctioned for their misconduct. And so we came back. But first we had to survive an appeal by Hanrahan and the cops and the feds to the U.S. Supreme Court. And we were able to slide by 5-3 in the Supreme Court.
Did you argue for the Supremes?
No, I have, but not in that case.
Who'd you bring in to hire that case?
Well, we didn't bring anybody in. What happened was certiorari was denied 5-3.
Oh,
so
I see.
The appeal was not accepted.
I see.
But there was dissents, which is unusual.
And what year was this? 79?
That
still?
Was 80.
So 80. So they're still dragging. So
it was still going on. So then that sends it back to the district court here in Chicago. We mercifully get a new judge. And there's a new U.S. attorney at that time, Dan Webb, of all people. And they decide, given now the cards, we have the cards rather than they have the cards, we work out a settlement, which was the largest settlement of a civil rights case back in...
And how much was that settlement?
It was around $2 million, which doesn't sound like much at all. But at that point, it was rather significant.
No, I remember at the time. You know, so 1980 was when the settlement was agreed to?
1983.
1983.
Yeah.
That's 14 years later.
13. Well, we filed the suit in 13 or 14 years.
Yeah. 14 years after Fred Hampton was killed.
Yeah.
And so the money went to the Fred Hampton's, well, they weren't married, were they? Was it a widow?
Well, she was also a plaintiff. So it was split up among the people that survived and the families of the two, Mark and Fred.
Now, Flint, I'm sure you've been asked this question, but I don't think I've ever asked it of you. When this began in 1969, you, as you said, you weren't even a lawyer. You were a law school student. When it ended with the settlement in 83, you were 14 years down the road.
Mm-hmm.
You committed 14 years of your life to this case. That's highly unusual. I applaud you for tenacity. People make fun of me because I endlessly write about TIFFs. But I think you've even gone beyond me in this particular case. Were there times along the road where you thought you were losing your mind? Were there times along the road where you thought, I don't know, I should just go work for a corporate lawyer? I mean, were there times along the road where you attempted just to throw it away?
Well, there were times when you felt very down. I mean, going to that courtroom every day for 18 months and knowing that everybody in the courtroom was going to treat you like you were crazy, the judge, the lawyers for the other side who are being paid large amounts of money by the county and by the city and the government to fight us. Sure, that would, you know, and when the judge throws it out after 18 months, yeah, you know, that all of that was hard. But hey, it was just a preliminary event to spending 30 years fighting against police torture.
Wow. That was ladies and gentlemen, that 14-year ordeal was the preliminary. It was, I'm not quite sure I know what to say to that one. And so is that the end? Is that the closing of the books, legally speaking, on the Fred Hampton killing?
Well, We talk about both in the Hampton case and in the Burge torture cases how important it was not only to fight the cases in court but to change the narrative. And in the Hampton case, we and I use the term very much collectively, you know, the community, people, progressive politicians, and we changed the narrative from a shootout to a shoot-in, to a murder, to a political assassination.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's what we're fighting to this day to make sure that that doesn't change. And, I mean, if you look at the Tribune yesterday, I think there was reference to it being a shootout at one point. Or there's some question about whether it's a shootout or not. There's no question. You know, there's no question. We have to defend that people's narrative in the same way that the narrative in the torture cases went from a decorated Vietnam veteran commander of police, John Burge, versus a cop killer, Andrew Wilson,
mm-hmm.
to what we all know the narrative is now, which is notorious torturer, serial torturer, John Burge and his men, and over 100 people being tortured, African-American men, and that Richie Daley involved.
Who Richard Daley being, of course, the Richard M. Daley,
right.
Mayor of the city of Chicago, elected by you, the voters, six times, I want to say, Flint Taylor.
Yes.
Somehow or another, I managed never to vote for him in any of those elections. How about that? I did vote for him in 1984. I sit here. I must confess this to you, Flint Taylor. Let's see if you can do this. Who was he running against for state's attorney in 1984?
Well, I don't know, but that's right in the middle of when he was covering up the John Burge torture.
You know what? And I wish I had voted for the other guy. In 1984, Richard M. Daley was running for re-election as Cook County State's Attorney, and he was running against a Democrat-turned-Republican who had aligned himself with sort of the Bernie Epton wing. Poor Bernie Epton, let's leave his name out of it. Sort of the anti-Washington wing of the Republican Party that was hoping to use a white hysteria over Harold Washington to have a resurgence. I can't even call it a resurgence because Republicans have never been here. So let's just say to establish, you know, a foothold in the city of Chicago. His name?
Ed Verdoliak?
No. Negatory. Ed Verdoliak at the time was chairman of the Democratic Party. At the time, in 1984, the Republican candidate for state's attorney was a former police chief in Chicago named Richard Brezak.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we could spend another show on Brezak,
Richard Brezak. Because Richard Brezak was, I put this in air quotes, more or less what would I say in terms of the police torture cases, stand-up guy, I don't know if that's accurate. Hero, I don't know if that's accurate. What would the word be that you would use to describe? I know, I realize we're out of time to take this deep dive, but how would you define Richard Brezak's role?
Well, I'm not going to use a word, but I'm going to say that in 1982, when it was revealed that Andrew Wilson was tortured by John Burge, and Brezak wrote a cover-your-ass letter to Daily.
Okay.
So maybe he was less implicated
a little bit. Maybe he was prudent. How about that? That's a word, prudent.
Well,
he was prudent to cover his bohunkus. Anyway, I voted for Richard Daley because Harold had endorsed him. So that's good enough for Harold. It's good enough for me. But we talk about the narrative, the changing narrative. I know you have to go, but let's just close with this. The changing narrative. I lived through all this stuff, Flint Taylor. I was following it as a kid, reading newspapers. I was as obsessed then as I am now. And you retelling the stories just brought back so many memories of columns that I read. Tom Fitzpatrick for the Sun-Times wrote a lot of columns about Sam Perry, or just bringing back memories. And I see the FBI has sort of changed the narrative about itself. And I wonder if you just would talk about that for a moment. The FBI in TV shows now, some of their agents are presented as heroes, as people who are ahead of their time on investigations. I'm thinking of one particular Netflix series that my wife and I just watched about serial murders and the FBI investigation of serial murders. So what's your thoughts about the changing narrative of the FBI?
Don't fall for it. I feel like when you look at, you know, Mueller and how he was made, into a kind of a semi-god by our side, so to speak, got to remember Mueller's involvement with Ashcroft in the post 9/11 cases and specifically in terms of countenancing torture I think it was Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't really think that the FBI, of course, has been scrubbing itself. And they wrote a document, and I'll close with this. In 1964, they wrote a COINTELPRO document, and it said, no matter what it's called, COINTELPRO will survive in one form or another, no matter what happens. And so even though it was disbanded by name in 1971, I think we've seen instances of it before, and we have to be, you know, we have the black identity extremist issue of the FBI now. So I think we shouldn't fall for that.
All right, very good. I'll try not to fall for that when I watch these shows. Flint Taylor, tell everybody the name of the book that you wrote and where they can get it, the publisher. Let's make sure to give a shout-out to the publisher and all the good information.
It's called The Torture Machine, Racism and Police Violence in Chicago. It's Haymarket Books, and you can get it at various independent bookstores around the city. Also, of course, from Haymarket and perhaps from that large corporation that shall not be named.
Large corporation. No. Go buy it at an independent bookstore. That old large corporation that shot it. You know, he caught me there. I'm like, what large? Oh, yeah, I know what he's talking about. All right, Flint Taylor. It's my negligence for not having you on earlier. That was a fascinating tale that you just told. And maybe we can take the deep dive into John Burge sometime, which is really one of the most depressing chapters in Chicago political history and police history that we're still sort of very much living. I think we're still living under what happened to Fred Hampton, because that narrative, you're right, is an absolute fight to keep it from being changed. But the John Burge one is ongoing to this day.
You bet.
All right, very good.
I'd love to be back.
That's Flint Taylor. I'm Ben Jarofsky's bonus time of the Ben Jarofsky Show. Take care, everybody.